WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and happy 100th birthday to one of our greatest institutions, the New York Public Library. And as if to show its commitment to both the past and the future, to the physical and the virtual, the library with the lions out front is handing out 25,000 books, displaying an incredible array of materials in an in-person library exhibition, and releasing its first ever iPad app, all, of course, for free. The book is called Know the Past, Find the Future, a new paperback guide to the library's collections with favorites highlighted by everyone from Stephen Colbert to Yoko Ono to the Harlem Globetrotters. The exhibition lets you come visit some of those gems, from a Harry Houdini letter to a Charles Dickens letter opener to a Mary Shelley hair. The app is a self-guiding multimedia tour through the library's collection of artifacts from the 1939 World's Fair. And this weekend they'll have live music and theater, lectures, tours, and much more. So let's celebrate 100 years of the New York Public Library with its outgoing president, Dr. Paul LeClerc. Dr. LeClerc, always good to see you, and I don't know if it's appropriate to congratulate one person on 100 years of the library as opposed to congratulating the whole city that it's here, but congratulations.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's great to be back with you.
And listeners, we invite you now to call in and tell us about the most interesting item that you have ever used or looked at in the New York Public Library. Maybe we'll get some interesting stuff out there from some of you. You heard me mention some of the artifacts that they're displaying from 100 years of the library's history. What are some of the most interesting items, or one most interesting item, it can be a book or it can be a non-book, that you have used or looked at in the New York Public Library? 212-433-WNYC. That's our on-air number, not our pledge line. We will never ask you for money when you're on the air. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Dr. LeClerc, you said recently that the library has 60 million items and books are only a quarter of them. Is that right?
That's right. This is what we call a universal collection, and it represents the written and, in many cases, spoken and pictorial documentation of human life, human culture, human aspiration over about 5,000 years. And one of the remarkable things about the library is that we collect in so many different kinds of formats. And everybody always thinks of libraries as places for books, and indeed they are. I mean, that's a central part. That's a central part of our collecting policy, and those books are used hugely by our public. But at the same time, we collect all kinds of different things, because what we're doing is documenting cultural output and human output in different kinds of formats. So what we decided to do with this centennial exhibit that opened to the public this past Saturday is to show how immense and how varied the collections are.
And what will people see if they come to the exhibition at the main branch of Bryant Park?
The hard part for the wonderful curator, Thomas Mellons, was to choose 200 objects out of 60 million. So that's sort of what's on display is maybe 3/1 millionths of the library's total collection. So you named a number of things that are out for people to see. We have Malcolm X's briefcase. We made a very important decision at the outset, and that is to not only to show the diversity of the library's collections, but also to show that we collect both the good and the bad.
The bad, like?
The bad, like Mein Kampf, an edition that Hitler gave as a present, as a wedding present to a couple. We also have on display, in effect, a shocking kind of item, and that is a women's Ku Klux Klan outfit that is from the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture. And the bottom line principle is that we think it's better for people to know than to not know, to see rather than not to see. So the range of objects is exceptional. It goes from campaign buttons from past elections. It goes from materials from the GMHC archive, which is one of the key archives that we have in the LGBT collections, to very, very high-end kinds of things like Thomas Jefferson's handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence,
wow,
to the Gutenberg Bible. But it is decidedly not a treasures exhibit. I mean, we made a very, very specific decision at the outset not to simply show treasures, but to show a variety of kinds of things that start to give the public a sense of how significant, substantial, and important the collections are.
And we'll talk about some of the history, fascinating history, of a library, maybe the library, over the last 100 years as we go along in this conversation, and what you're doing that's new. You may notice I have an iPad sitting right here.
I saw that.
With your brand new app loaded about the 1939 World's Fair. But, you know, we already have a full board of callers.
Great.
Of people who want to tell us about some of the most interesting things that they've ever used at the library. Let's listen to some of these. Nick in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. The most all-around interesting thing that I think I found at the library is microfilms of old New York City telephone books. And I was able to track the various addresses and movements of long-gone relatives and get a really good picture of my family in New York City.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Using old telephone book microfilms for sort of genealogical research.
Well, you know, I did the same kind of thing some years back in a Carnegie-era library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, where I was born, because I wanted to find out where the house was that my parents lived. So, you know, libraries are the most wonderful storehouses of information, and you never know what use your collection is going to be put to. But being able to trace your family history as you did, sir, you know, makes me feel really good that you could do that with us.
You were born in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Did your parents teach at Dartmouth?
No, actually, my parents were at the other end of the educational spectrum. They were both Depression-era children, right, and they had to drop out of high school to go to work
and
to support their families.
And then didn't you go to, like, Catholic high school in Flushing?
Well, I only went to Catholic schools, except for graduate school at Columbia. You know, I went to Catholic elementary and high school in Bayside and in Flushing, and then a Jesuit college.
Maggie in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Segway, what's the most interesting thing you've used at the library?
Well, in the 12th grade, I had to write a report about the Rosenbergs and their trial. So I went to the library, and I found in the archives, a copy of a jello box that had been cut in half. And on the opposite side of the jello box were the instructions of how to make the bomb, partial instructions.
Wow.
So I got to use this information for my report. So I found that to be very fascinating, that this piece of information was somewhere stuck deep, deep, deep within that library, because it took quite a while to track them down.
Talk about a back of the envelope
plot.
It's
amazing. And you held that in your hands?
Yeah, well, it was a copy. I mean, it wasn't the actual jello box.
Okay.
But, yeah, I got to look at it and see their writing, and supposedly their writing, and read about it, because it was in a reference book. So it was really quite thrilling.
Was there any explanation as to why it was a jello box as opposed to a box of Tide or anything else?
Yes. No, not why it was a jello box. But apparently they were using items such as a jello box, to not call any attention to the passing of information. So they were cutting them in odd ways with a wave, like the cut wasn't a straight cut, it was in a wave pattern. It was not cut normally.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating.
clearly made an impression on you.
Absolutely. And why wouldn't it? So I'm almost amazed that the New York Public Library is only 100 years old as we celebrate the centennial. What did people do for books in New York before 1911?
Well, the building is 100 years old. But the library was incorporated in 1895, and it was an amalgamation of two pre-existing collections, John Jacob Astor's collection, which was in the Astor Library, which is now where the Public Theater is. When you're at the Public Theater seeing a show, you're in a former reading room, actually. And so the public had access to books there, and then the second library was James Lennox's Library of Rare Books, which the public had very limited access to. There were some pre-existing neighborhood libraries, some by the Archdiocese of New York, such as Epiphany, St. Agnes, we still keep some of these names, and on 2nd Avenue and about 4th Street, there's the oldest library in our system, which is called the Ottendorfer Library, which was created by a successful German businessman to serve the information needs of the German-speaking community there.
And the building is the thing that's 100 years old now.
Right.
So talk about the building, the famous building with the lions.
Well, the building is, I think, easily one of the greatest public buildings in America, certainly one of the most important Beaux-Arts building in America. It was designed by Carrère and Hastings, both of whom studied at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. I think it's as great and grand and palatial as it is for two reasons. One, New York has always been an ambitious city, and at the turn of the last century, the ambition of those involved philanthropically in the city at that time was to build a library that would be on a par with the libraries of the great European capitals, especially Berlin, London, and Paris, because they were positioning New York to be an equal to those kinds of cities. The second reason, I think, is that Boston built the Boston Public Library first, and it was small by comparison with what New York built, and so New York had to go Boston one better and show itself as the leading cultural capital of America.
Even when the Yankees were only 8 years old, we had to start competing with Boston. We're talking about 100 years of the New York Public Library with the library's outgoing president, Paul Leclerc. And taking your calls on the most interesting item you've ever used at the library, Elizabeth in Washington Heights. You're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a toss-up. I was really moved by a letter by Lincoln's personal physician who attended the body at the apartment across from the Ford Theater when Lincoln was shot. And I also really, really enjoy the 8 Book of Psalms, which I've used in preparing for leading services. I was also reminded by a previous caller, we actually found my husband's father, from whom my husband was estranged, by using phone books of the cities to which we believed my father-in-law might have moved.
Fascinating. Elizabeth, thank you. Now, when we think about the library today, it's everything from the keeper of knowledge to a job-hunting assistant service in the Great Recession, to an after-school babysitter for working parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really evolved. Would you say it's evolved from an elite institution to an everybody institution?
No, I think the library has always been there for everyone. What makes the New York Public Library different from all other libraries in history, that's not an exaggeration, is the fact that, on the one hand, it's a combination of magisterial research library collections that don't circulate, that are kept within the research libraries. And at the same time, it's a collection of neighborhood libraries that Andrew Carnegie built with a proviso that the city would give us, the nonprofit corporation, the foundation, the operating funds. So the whole ethos behind the library is democratic accessibility. Anyone can use this library from anywhere in the world. There is no other great library in history that has ever permitted everybody to come in the way we do.
Helen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. What interesting item have you used at the library?
Well, I was researching my husband's family, who were originally from Warsaw, came here in 1906, and I wanted to know who was left in Warsaw at the start of the war. And your microfilm collection had Warsaw telephone books.
Warsaw telephone books.
Yes, 37, 38, 39.
Wow. Those years just before the war?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, that must be of such value. And I didn't know about that. My own family is Jewish from Poland and came early in the 20th century. And, you know, they say it's very hard to do genealogy if you're an Eastern European Jew, because so many of the records were destroyed in the Holocaust along, you know, with people being killed. So if they have phone books from 1937 to 39 Warsaw, that's an incredible resource in that way.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And Paul Leclerc, now when you became president in 1993, the library didn't have a website. The web, as we know, it didn't exist.
Right.
Now you're celebrating the 100th birthday in part by releasing your first iPad app. How much has the online world changed your mission? Because when you talk about housing all these research materials, you know, in theory, you don't need a physical library anymore because you can do the kind of research online for the world's stored knowledge that you never could before.
Well, yes and no. Remember that only a quarter of our materials are books. And those books that are not in the public domain, protected by copyright, we're not putting online. So you're going to have to come to us to see those, and you're going to have to come to us to see all the unique kinds of materials that the callers have been talking about, and then millions and millions more. At the same time, the core mission of the library is to take information and make it freely accessible. So what the web has permitted us to do is to expand that mission out to a global audience instantaneously in 24 hours a day. One example, we created something called the New York Public Library Digital Gallery, 800,000 images online for free worldwide use. There were between 10 and 12.5 million downloads of those images a month. It's like 120 million a year.
Incredible.
So what these new technologies in the web and search engines permitted us to do was to blow open the collections and let countless people have access to them around the world.
So speaking of 1939 and Warsaw, by implication, I downloaded your first ever iPad app, which is just out, which is about the 1939 World's Fair. And it's free, folks, if you want to download the app called Biblion, if you happen to have an iPad. It's really fun to see these artifacts of history to browse through on my screen. And what a time in our history, 10 years into the Great Depression, just before World War II, with Hitler already on the march in Europe. I'm looking right now at the newspaper headline, World's Fair Bomb Kills Two Detectives, a photo of Hitler, and a cartoon reacting to Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia saying the fair should have a chamber of horrors in which Hitler would be the main exhibition. That's what LaGuardia said. But the cartoon is Hitler reading a newspaper headline that says LaGuardia dislikes Hitler. Like, what do I care about some upstart mayor of New York? So this is a fascinating app with those historical artifacts right at our fingertips.
It's totally brilliant. And I think it's a game changer in terms of the way that it presents material. It's really, really astonishing. The people from Apple are sort of ecstatic about it because they've never seen anything like this before from anybody.
And you can look at those photos, you can look at videos, you can look at text, all those things, and it's for free, as the things you get from the library are. By the way, let me ask you about a digital book controversy. I've heard about the conflict between libraries and publishers over e-books. An e-book, of course, can in theory last forever, but the publishers want libraries to have to rebuy them after every 14 uses, is that the right number? Because they claim that's how quickly a physical book would fall apart?
Well, that's only one publisher.
It is only one publisher?
That's only one publishing house. We are the biggest circulator of e-books in America. Hundreds of thousands a year circulate. And what we do through an organization with which we contract is that we, in effect, buy, let's say, 20 copies of Moby Dick. Okay, and you can check that out with your library card, and it will go to your computer and stay on your computer for 3 weeks and then disappear. And if all 20 copies are checked out, then you wait for it. So it's as if it were a physical book on a shelf. There is one publisher, and we pay a fee for that service. I mean, we buy that, but then we let the public use those books for free, just as we buy regular books and the public can check them out. This particular publisher, which will go unnamed, wants to limit the time span with which we can lend these e-books. The other publishers don't. So,
Though they may be trying to set an industry standard. And not that publishers aren't having a hard time these days, too.
Right.
But the average number of checkouts of a hardcover or paperback book before you have to replace it has to be a lot more than 14.
I think so, unless it's written on tissue paper.
Is there such a thing as a most checked out list at the library, like a bestseller list at a bookstore? Would you know the most checked out books of the year or of your 18-year tenure?
I would have had the answer had I known the question in advance. But I can tell you when there's a new Harry Potter book, they fly off the shelf. We buy thousands of copies of those. And we try to be as responsive as we possibly can to reader demands and to what's hot and what's new. But it's a question of finances as well.
So we have 30 seconds for you to tell me, after 18 years as president of the New York Public Library and now going on to other things, what you would like your legacy to be.
Oh, wow. I would like to see to be seen as the person who expanded the library's outreach in its physical buildings by helping to get the libraries open 6 days a week and maintaining maximum access to physical libraries as spaces for all New Yorkers to use, as well as having been there when we made this huge transformational change in terms of an online presence. And if there's one legacy I'd point to, it's maximizing access, democratic access for free.
And listeners, a lot of access this weekend, special exhibitions in honor of the 100th birthday of the New York Public Library main branch building, at the branch, all kinds of things going on there, an incredible amount online as well, and in the new book that they're distributing for free and telling people, once you finish with this book, leave it on a park bench somewhere so other people can look at it, called Know the Past, Find the Future, the New York Public Library at 100. Paul Leclerc, thank you so much and best of luck.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us another hour to come.